conversations with you. You'll know that you're at a CNU session because I'm supposed to tell you, there's this little form you can sign up on for AIA credits. And so that's that announcement. If we can get the lights down somehow here, we have a person that knows how those buttons work. Okay. So I'm going to frame this from the perspective of transit-oriented development and right-sizing parking, and then share some brand new research with you. We'll take a couple questions from each panelist as we go through this, and then save questions for the end. So, you know, Michael Eisner is quoted in Chuck Boll's book on centers on that form follows parking, and I think we also now understand that performance follows parking. And so, in terms of transit-oriented development, we have this kind of Gordian knot or a puzzle that we need to deal with. We have a lot of research, a lot of information that now tells us conclusively that TODs behave differently in terms of travel, yet there is no definitive industry guidance on parking ratios for TODs. So if you want to do them, you get to have the pain and anguish of trying to prove your own individual project. We know that lenders tend to require conventional ratios for transit-oriented development, and developers tend to build transit-oriented development with conventional ratios. So the challenge is if we need to change parking if we're going to realize the benefits for transit-oriented development fully. In the last 11 years, in the United States, we've invested about $75 billion in new urban rail transit in the United States, according to the American Public Transit Association. While that's not as big as the highway number, I think any way that you count, $75 billion is a big number. There's market and planning support for TOD, but because we're parking TODs like conventional development on the whole, many of the hopeful benefits of transit-oriented development haven't been realized. Less time stuck in traffic, lower housing costs, or just two of a long list of benefits that we could talk about. In part, just to keep hammering away at that, is because most transit-oriented development is parked oblivious to the presence of transit because it's required to be built and parked like auto-oriented development. So it's a huge challenge. Some of you understand the relationship between transit-oriented and transit-adjacent development. Transit-adjacent development is essentially the evil twin of TOD. It's development next to transit that doesn't behave like it's next to transit. And parking is one of the key differences there. In development projects, how we deal with parking is often a deal breaker. Based on the 2008 information we have on building parking, structured parking costs about 4 to 10-fold more than surface parking, and a simple structured parking lot in 2008 numbers is about $17,500 a space if you want an ugly structured lot. If you want a beautiful one, it's going to cost you a lot more. So parking becomes a financial barrier and a physical barrier in terms of achieving urbanism and walkability. So in doing these kinds of projects, we deal with often what I will call a five-act TOD morality play. Act one is vision, and you know the citizens adopt a transit village plan, and everybody is excited, which is Act two, optimism. A transit-supportive developer comes forward, and we think this great thing is going to happen. Act three, the same people that adopted the plan say, well, that's not really what I meant, and it's going to have too much density and too many trips in my neighborhood. Act four is compromise, and we lower the density, we lower the reduction in parking, and so the lesson from the morality play is we get a lower density, less financially feasible project that has fewer TOD benefits, and this morality play plays out every day in neighborhoods across the United States, and it's a real challenge because we end up with less of what we want. So, some new parking research. We've been working, and the we in this case is PB Placemaking, Robert Severo at the University of California at Berkeley, the Center for Transit-Oriented Development, and the Urban Land Institute, doing research for about the last 3 years. This is very close to being published now. The research results have been accepted. And what we've been doing is looking at 17 built transit-oriented development projects across the United States. All are multiple family. They're drawn from four different metropolitan areas, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, San Francisco, Bay Area, and Portland. And what we tried to do was to measure actual performance of transit-oriented development and compared those to what ITE would have predicted. In doing that, the first thing that you find is that there's a big disconnect between reality and the ITE guidance. The ITE guidance has a suburban bias in terms of the existing parking standards. It assumes that everyone drives, and where they don't drive, and it measures TOD, it does it based on 7 TODs in Florida, and if you've ever been to Florida, you know that that's the wrong starting point. It also overstates trip generation for transit-oriented development, and so as a result, we end up with higher development impact fees because we're assuming that there's more travel happening, and on a 24-hour basis, based on our research, it's about 50% too high. So, you know, and remember, Severo teaches statistics at Berkeley, so we didn't just make the numbers up. So parking is, and we believe that parking is likely to be overstated by the same amount, by about 50%. So if you look at that in terms of absolute numbers, ITE would tell you you get about 6.67 trips per multiple family unit. In reality, based on our research, you got 3.55 trips per unit on average applying across the 17. So let's look at them real quickly. They're going to vary because the places vary, the transit varies, the density varies, and I think that's important in terms of how you apply this. In the two examples in Philadelphia and New Jersey, they averaged 27% below the ITE 24-hour rates, in part because these are lower density residential product, and it's served by commuter rail with limited midday and evening service. In Washington, D.C., this is the best example. Five case studies there. You can see where those are in the Washington, D.C. region. Greatest reduction from the ITE rates. They range between 30% below and 92% below the ITE rates. On average, the TODs we measured in the Washington, D.C. area were 60% below what ITE talked about. The Meridian at Braddock Station, just to provide more data, averaged one vehicle trip for every two units. So, you know, that's significantly different than what we see with conventional development. Portland metropolitan area, similar kinds of results, but not as impressive, certainly, as Washington, D.C. Looked at a range of residential products across the region. On average, 40% lower than the ITE 24-hour rate. Collins Circle, which is the best performing project that we found in Portland, had one trip per unit as opposed to that 6.77, and you can see how that worked across the transect in Portland. The closer the projects were to downtown, the better the performance. San Francisco Bay Area, these are all in East Bay. They're all next to BART. So they're all quote-unquote suburban, if East Bay really is suburban. They averaged 48% below ITE's 24-hour average, and the Mauna Loa homes averaged just 2.5 trips per unit. In that one, 55% of the people commute by BART, and it's just 950 feet away from the South Hayward Station, and distance is important. So then the next thing that we did is we took the data, and we said, let's try to solve for what that means with one independent variable. Let's look at laying out four different typical residential TOD prototypes, garden apartments, Texas donut, townhomes, and six-story mid-rise. And the independent variable will be, we'll test it with a transit-supportive ratio of 2.2 spaces per unit and a more friendly ratio of 1.1 spaces per unit. And this is how that plays out. So in terms of garden apartments, you ended up with 33% more density by cutting the parking in half. on that 8-acre theoretical site, that's 60 more units, and including the increase in parking spaces that you'd need by that increase in density, you still ended up with a net savings of $98,000 on parking. That's assuming that's all surface parked. With the townhomes, same relationship with the density. Obviously, a few more units because we're dealing with a denser product, and just over a $700,000 parking savings. As you start to move into higher density product with surface with structured parking instead of surface, you start to get into really significant savings on parking costs, but not as much increase in the overall density, but more units. So with the Texas Donut, a 20% increase in density, an additional 162 units, so each one of those had to have a parking space, but you still save $5.3 million in the overall capital cost. Same thing, but more dramatic with the mid-rise, a $12 million savings in the capital cost. So let's look just at some of the quick implications, and then we can take a couple of questions. So from cutting the ratio from 2.2 to 1.1, you ended up with 20 to 33% higher residential density. You ended up with more units, but lower parking costs, between 5 and 36% lower parking costs. And you get higher transit ridership because of more units next to transit. And you end up with more opportunity. The developer can make a lot more money because he doesn't have to spend it on parking. You could end up with greater housing affordability because you can afford to make the units more affordable because you don't have to spend as much on parking. Or you can end up with more projects being built because now they're more financially feasible because they don't have to carry the cost of all that additional parking. Or you could end up with all of the above. The other thing is that we should start to look at some of the policy implications of that in terms of standards. One of the really big ones and one of the ones that you have to think about a little bit is that developers would end up paying lower fees and extractions because in a lot of the United States we have development impact fees based on the predicted amount of trips that are going to be generated by a project. Well, if the TOD has half as many trips, the fees should be half as much. Well, the other thing that we do with those fees is we then use them to build roads, and we use that trip generation information to size the road. So we're building our roads twice as big as we should be because there's half as many trips, which then increases on a larger basis auto dependency, which shouldn't be happening. We would get better transit ridership, so better return on transit. We'd have the public paying less for TOD housing because we can now use land more efficiently, get greater density, and then we get those increases in density of 20 to 33%. So where does all this stand? We have final comments back from the panel. We're working with ITE and ULI to get this into their guidance and practice. The report will be published and available later this year, but TCRP is notoriously slow, and so I can't guarantee when we can hand you something. But anyway, any quick questions before we move on?
Did the parking cost, did it assume structured parking or
repaid there? In the first two, in the garden apartments and in the townhomes, it assumes surface parking. And in the second one, it assumed structured parking. And we didn't try to do anything like mixed unit types to get more land efficiency. We only wanted to have one independent variable, and that was the parking ratio. There's clearly a relationship between the service levels, and except for the New Jersey, Philadelphia example, these are all with robust, high-quality transit. I don't think you'll get the same results if you have, for lack of a better term, crappy transit. We wanted to have good numbers to show what was possible. We did not try to look at retail because we were trying to just deal with single uses, but you'll get better results if retail is nearby. I think all the analysis shows that, and Brian Bochner has some work that's coming forward on mixed use that correlates fairly well with some of this. So I'll take one more question, and then we'll move on. So in the back. They think that they're interesting. they think that they're interesting enough that they want us to work with them and to have guidance. We've been they helped approve the methodology. They reviewed all of the works along the way because we wanted to make sure that we were never at a point where they could say you did that wrong. We'll be presenting this at the ITE annual meeting in August, so that it will be there in front of ITE, and we intend to be an irritant in their side if they don't find it interesting. But I think that they will. So. All right. Let's see. We've got to go to your first slide, though, don't we? Cool.
Okay. You didn't want to start with your first slide?
That's the first slide. sure. I'm Brian Aluni with 20 Allison Partners. I'm a design architect, and people ask me, well, why do you get interested in parking if you really all you want to do is design the outside of these buildings? And if you look at the outside of these buildings, it really doesn't matter much when you've got all that sea of parking in front of, those buildings there. And you know what happens? People really just don't care about designing those buildings when you get that kind of parking there. So when we design buildings, the most special places we make today require creative parking management strategies to make them happen. This particular project has a managed parking system that guides you to the particular two parking garages that were surrounding it. This project here, which is the Green in Dayton, Ohio, it also has private parking meters in all the internal streets. The meters then serve the money that is generated by those meters go into a fund that's a nonprofit that nonprofits within the Dayton community can apply to get resources from. Neil and I generated this chart for an article we had written about 2 years ago talking about the different types of parking solutions along the transect. Basically it goes from surface park solutions here to structured park solutions here to perhaps underground solutions as you get to the T6 levels. At the lower parts of the transect, you'll find that most parking, good new urban parking solutions, utilize the concept of placing the parking within the fourth layer, behind the buildings, behind the public realm, screened in some way from the street environment. In the opposite end of the transect, the better parking solutions utilize some notion of shared parking, and this is the particular concept from the smart code. And when you get into some pretty advanced town center projects, putting down, how much is that? I think this is 1 million square feet plus or minus, you start doing some pretty funky analyses of the parking loads, and depending on your developer, they'll decide what they want their ratio to be in the end. And in this particular case, they and the jurisdiction agreed on a 4.45 number of spaces per thousand. Again, this has the only transit this has is bus service, this particular project. When we're designing projects, we're very careful, as GB described, to watch the costs of parking. Different parking facilities have different costs. Surface lots can go from anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 a space. Parking, when you make them nice and you make them out of pavers, they go up to 10,000 a space. Unadorned parking decks are anywhere from 14 to 20,000. A wrapped parking garage is 14 to 20. When you have to put a facade on it, you can add $5,000 to that for space. And if you're going underground, you can go anywhere from 30 to what I heard earlier in the conference, 60,000 for underground spaces, depending on if you're trying to take out rock or water or other kinds of issues underground. And above ground decks aren't necessarily all equal. This is two projects that we're working on, or worked on, three projects actually. This is a very inexpensive precast deck surrounded by residential, sort of screening the deck from the public realm in Fairfax, Virginia. The same solution we use at our transit at TOD design for Twin Brook. The project below that is in Philadelphia, in East Village, near a SEPTA station, and this uses a podium parking garage. That podium garage is probably $5,000 to $6,000 a space more than the precast deck. So when we use them, we're very careful when we implement them in the design. And in this particular case, it was the best way to get the building to be what the public realm needed. When you look at residential construction, we track these numbers in our practice. From four-story wood construction to light gauge metal construction to concrete construction. And our clients debate and agonize over whether they should choose one of these construction types over another. But in reality, the biggest jump in the price of residential construction has to do with the parking systems that are used. So you get a $30,000 jump per unit if you have to use above-grade, cheap parking structures, and a $40,000 to $50,000 bump in parking when you're doing below-grade parking. And part of the reason that this is, the ratios, even though this parking is more expensive, is that you have more spaces per unit up here than you do down here, because usually these are in more urban spaces. But still, it's the biggest impact on the cost of residential construction today, parking. Well, we've done a lot of work in Washington along the metro system, and there's actually more stars that we could put on this map, but this was done maybe 3 or 4 years ago as a chart to describe that where we've placed projects along the Washington metro system. Actually, I'm going to talk a little bit about the red line arm right here. What's interesting to note about these projects, these are four projects, one of which was in your study, at metro stations along the red line in Montgomery County. Each project had a different structured parking solution, and this is interesting to know. Actually, two are the same. Twin Brook here and Grosvenor are both wrap parking decks. The Grosvenor is not a particularly nice installation if you know the project. Rockville has a very interesting solution where they initial design for this had all the parking underground, and that was so expensive we found a way to it was actually cheaper to go partly upgrade and single load the residential construction, adding cost to the residential construction, but greatly reducing the cost of the parking. White Flint is all underground, and that project, actually that's not true. There's one level of parking above the Whole Foods, and the only reason that's there is that Whole Foods now requires in their lease that there's a separate, that none of the residential waste products enter their store. They need a clean ceiling. So in order to resolve that as inexpensively as possible, we ended up putting a parking level up there to act as that transition zone. A lot of buildings are putting in false floors just to resolve that issue for Whole Foods. It's incredibly onerous. If anyone's here from Whole Foods, it's an incredibly onerous thing you're doing, taking costs away from the public realm and from other places in buildings that where they can be spent more effectively. But that's what they're doing. We do inner city work. In D.C., this is a lot of buildings in Columbia Heights. If you know the story of Columbia Heights, 40 years ago yesterday, this community was destroyed the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. It went into dormancy, and it sat fallow for a long time until a metro station was opened. And the city, who gained all these properties on tax foreclosure, the retailers and the commercial institutions that were there after they were burned up decided just to take the tax money and walk and let their land get taken over by the city. They organized themselves and put out design competitions for developers or developer competitions to bring up this entire community at one time. So 40 years later, with the addition of transit, we now have an incredibly new, vibrant community within the heart of the district. One other thing to say about this project, all of these buildings park at roughly one space per unit, partly because this building and this building actually have the metro tunnels running underneath them. And part of the reason I love parking is that it can be the solution that wins us competitions. This is a project we just won for Poplar Point in Washington, D.C. The new national stadium is right here. The U.S. Capitol is right about up here. This is the Potomac River. This is the Anacostia River. This is the existing historically African-American community of Anacostia. The Frederick Douglass House is right here where the blue dots are. The site is this piece of land here, which, you know, in 100 years ago, none of this land existed. This was all part of the Anacostia wetlands, and Anacostia fronted onto the water. They brought in landfill, and they built this highway that segregated Anacostia from the river. And we did this plan where we put a lid over the highway that connected the existing community of Anacostia to the new neighborhood, and actually more than neighborhood, multiple neighborhoods that we're going to be building over the next 15, 20 years in the District of Columbia. This is a zero carbon community, by the way, something John Torrey is very proud of, and we all are. But the real solution I think helped us win this was the fact that we made this connection. And how did we do that? We did that by creating above grade parking that created a new surface plane for the city, so that these parking decks raised the whole grade. We put the roads on top of it, and therefore we're able to create this kind of place. And so when you look at this plan, you should, the actual ground plane that you'll see, much like Park Avenue in New York City, is raised in the areas that are coated red. I'm going to talk a little bit about suburban standards, because suburban standards have so much impact on our TODs. When you plan in green commercial uses in greenfield areas, because of the way codes are typically written, half the land ends up getting used. For single-story uses, half the land gets used for parking. When you go to two stories, two-thirds of the land gets used for parking. Multiple stories, you end up using most of the land for a surface lot. However, vertically parking can be efficient. Four levels of parking equals two stories of retail. In what I do, we think that the value we're selling is in the public realm. We don't want to waste its edges on parking decks. They barely contribute, and no one really benefits. So when I was with David Schwarz's office, we did this project called Southlake, where we decided to try to find a block of two-story commercial uses that envelops parking load within its envelope in a precast deck, the most efficient structured parking deck one can create. And it grows from a surface condition day one into a structured project over time. That's what the town square looks like at that project. But doing this analysis, we learned a little bit about what parking, when you're trying to make a nice place and trying to make nice edges on all four sides of a block and enveloping the parking load that block has, you end up creating some enormous blocks. This is downtown Fort Worth, 200 by 200 blocks. A two-story commercial block is 400 by 400 feet, plus or minus. It's basically four city blocks of Fort Worth. In fact, in order to resolve this in the urban realm, we've created these sort of streets that die into the parking decks. When you're walking along here, they look like regular streets, but you turn the corner, you'll see there's a parking deck there. If you do four stories of commercial uses, you end up with a block that's roughly 900 by 500 feet in size. And I'll talk about that project in a moment. I want to talk a little bit about how these numbers come about, why you have to provide so much parking. It's all based upon peaks in different seasons. For theaters, the peak is at the end of December, right after the Christmas season. For hospitality, it's in July. And for retail, obviously, it's in December. It's in that period just before Christmas. But there's also daily peaks, and the peaks, hourly peaks for each use. And this is how shared parking can help add, help balance all these parking loads by managing these peaks together, as most of you will know. But what's interesting is that if you look at a peak chart that a lot of these the parking analysts do, and this is from Mary Smith, what they'll do is they'll, and this is for an airport, but it's very similar to what they do for retail. They will pick the 85th percentile as the design, is where they'll design the lot, and that's how much parking they provide. So this is all the excess parking you can expect over the year. So in the least used day of the year, you'll have more parking available than you'll have used. And roughly for half the year, one-third of the parking lot will sit empty. And for retail, it's even worse. For retail, about half the year, 40% will sit empty. There are solutions to this, but these diagrams assume that there's 15% available spaces so that you can circulate around and find a space. So that it assumes there's an automatic assumption of 15% waste. And there, you know, maybe the signal park systems and other kinds of guidance, parking guidance and information systems can help us reduce that 15%, because you can find your space and it lets you know where the available spaces are. That's one hope we have. I just briefly want to talk about this project. This is the project with the four-story commercial zone. Again, it was designed so that day one, until all the stuff in red was built, it'd be surface park, but over time it would incorporate these decks. That's what the project looks like. Again, this is a David Schwartz project. I just want to remind you of the parking costs, because this is going to feed into the analysis I'm about to do. This is the project that our client had designed, and he sold it to someone else who developed this plan here. And I'm going to talk about two blocks in that plan, or one block in that plan, in a moment. If you look at this block, it's pretty simple. It's just a dumb parking deck in the middle of a big block. The edges, all the urban realm is here. This block here has parking decks that die into buildings. It has some surface parking. It has a lot of underground parking. And it has, again, another building that a parking garage that dies into a building. When you look at the costs, this block has 1,100 spaces. This one has 1,300 spaces. But this block costs $21 million to build, just for the parking. This one costs $9 million for the parking. Same block. When you go over the entire project, same plan, same amount of cars, this plan costs $50 million more in parking to build, just because they've got to have sprinkler systems and firewalls and a whole bunch of other things that are really, if you thought about it, you can avoid those costs and spend the money where it matters, either on the public realm or put it in the developer's pocket. And I'm just going to end with some systems that may help us reduce these block sizes in the future. I'm very hopeful that the cost of parking machines will come down to allow us to create smaller blocks and store cars more efficiently in the future. And there's a developer in Berkeley named Patrick Kennedy who has done some very successful things using double lifts and triple lifts, parking stackers, to activate land that would have sat fallow because the parking requirements were the limiter on their development. So he's used these devices on the back of each of these projects to make one row, one drive aisle going in, but that stores more than what a typical drive aisle would store, and allowing for increased density in all these pieces of land. But thank you.
So, thank you. Some questions.
Sure. We'll take three questions, please.
Sure.
I went a little fast. Again, it's in the cost of the structured parking. Some of these garages will need facades. Some of the parking is underground in the plan on the left as opposed to the plan on the right. Some of the parking you'll need sprinkler systems because of its adjacency. You'll need party walls. You'll have to build a concrete block wall that wasn't in the design on the right. There's one deck called B1. And then there's 300 spaces of surface parking here that are around there. In this, there's two parking decks. There's 195 spaces of underground parking and 195 spaces of surface parking. So the thing that really pushes up this cost is the underground parking, to get the density to wrap that whole block. Because if you didn't do the underground parking, you would not be able to get enough wrapper on that block. So, yes?
Have you looked at the cost of doing, if you have a surface parking lot, and then you put a green roof over the top of it to help the residential, because let's say you have retail on the first floor, and so that's where it would be most parking anyway. But it's a lot cheaper to do it where you're not having lift cars up in the structure, and then it becomes a green space for the people around. I have no idea what the costs are on that, but I've heard that these guys.
Well, the Philadelphia project, for example, is going to have a courtyard on top of the parking garage. There's a concrete podium that serves as it's parking with retail in the front, and there's a concrete slab, and on that slab on the courtyard side will be a green roof effectively.
Do you have the cost of that per parking lot or something? No.
Not off the top of my head, sorry. Yes, sir. Last question. Yeah, well, we put in a lot of devices. Yeah, we tried to ameliorate that. And let me just tell you a great story about this project. We broke this edge of the block into multiple sides, so it seemed like smaller blocks. These end up reading like streets if you go to Frisco today. But yeah, it's huge. And in fact, the developer, like I said, he sold this off. And the reason he sold this off was that this was so important to all of us who designed it, who were forced to design it because of the standards. Even this is all with shared parking, that he actually went off, took his money, and he's investing it in a new parking machine. He's trying to bring the numbers down. We hope this is a temporary solution. So yes, we agree. I mean, this is a very large deck. One, two, three, it's four level. It's not. You'll see decks much bigger than this at airports. Yeah, I mean, the design intent is to not have people hanging out here, but to have them like try to get here. Rightly or wrongly, that's what the goal was, that we're going to spend our energy on this side of the street, and then this was going to be alley or back of house space, if you will. Well, one last question. What I don't show in this diagram is these two blocks here in Fort Worth. And unfortunately, what's happened is that because the blocks are so small in the city of Fort Worth, they've had to just cross over the street with a bridge of a garage. And nothing destroys the street more than bridging it with a big parking garage, as we all know. So, you know, my sincere hope is that the cost of some of these mechanized solutions comes down, that allows us to reactivate the value in cities like Fort Worth that have very small civic grids.
Thanks, Brian. That was great.
Thank you, sir. My name, again, is Jeff Tumlin. I'm with Nelson Nygaard in San Francisco. And I'm here to tell you that parking is destiny. And in fact, parking is the primary difference between transit-oriented development and transit-adjacent development. If you're dealing with parking at your TODs, the same as you're dealing with it elsewhere in your city, you are not building TOD. There's a whole host of problems with parking. One is that parking wastes land. We conveniently describe parking requirements in terms of spaces per 1,000 square feet of development, but when you convert that into 1,000 square feet of parking per 1,000 square feet of development, you can find that if your requirements are above 3 spaces per 1,000, you're requiring more parking than you are requiring land use. And as Bill Fulton tells us, the development game is really just first building a parking lot and then finding some kind of land use that can afford to pay for the cost of building that parking. Parking also wastes an extraordinary amount of money. When our minimum parking requirements exceed actual typical demand for space, every single one of those spaces is extraordinary economic waste. Parking also has a strong relationship with housing affordability. We find from Sedgwick Cook studies in the San Francisco Bay Area that for every space you include with a residential unit, you increase the price of that unit from about 15% to 30%, and you decrease the number of units you can build on a typical parcel by about 15% to 25%. Work that the Center for Neighborhood Technology and the Center for Transit-Oriented Development are doing shows the impact of driving till you qualify has on working families, that while people are searching for lower-cost housing, their transportation costs are increasing faster than they're saving on housing. We're also seeing work from Fannie Mae and elsewhere that if a family can get rid of a car through reduced auto dependency, they can qualify for an additional $100,000 to $150,000 in mortgage. We also notice that a parking space at about 300 to 330 square feet per space, when you include the drive aisles, is bigger than an efficiency apartment. And the result of all this is that every car gets four to seven spaces, depending upon what context you're in. So 4 to 7 homes per motor vehicle in a society in which we cannot even begin to house the people that we've got. We're requiring a massive amount of subsidy for housing their automobiles. There's also a relationship between how we supply and manage parking and traffic congestion. Every parking space, well, as Don Shoup tells us, is simply a fertility drug for cars. Why should we be providing more commuter parking spaces than we have roadway capacity to access those spaces? In addition, poorly managed parking, which Shoup talks about at a great deal, that produces people driving around in circles looking for parking, that represents between 8 to 74% of traffic in our downtowns, averaging around 20 to 30% of traffic. And we know that even in the most congested situations, if you remove only 10% of vehicles, you eliminate congestion. We're also beginning to do more research now on the relationship between parking and climate change. As many of you know, growth in VMT, vehicle miles traveled, has been greatly exceeding growth in population. These are charts from Growing Cooler, the evidence on urban development and climate change, redoing et al.'s book, available free at uli.org. It is now required reading, along with Don Shoup's The High Cost of Free Parking. What we see is that even under the most aggressive scenarios of fuel efficiency, that only puts us at 40% above 1990 levels by 2030, at a time when we're required to be 15 to 30% below those levels in order to achieve climate stability. In order to deal with climate change, we have no choice but to aggressively go after vehicle miles traveled. What we find when we look at what influences vehicle miles traveled, the biggest factor by far is how we build. Building densely, building walkably, building next to transit, it's a huge, huge factor. It's extremely important, and yet it's a factor that we can only achieve over the very long run. Most of our buildings are here now. While location matters a great deal, it's out there. So what we also find is that another huge factor in this is how we supply and manage parking. That in a commercial development side, I can cut the vehicle trip generation rate and the parking demand from any commercial development by about 20 to 25% simply by changing the way that we look at parking. Well, specifically by no longer hiding the cost of parking into the costs of goods and services. Nationally, transport represents about 20% of our CO2 problem. In California, it's about 40%. In urban places, it's between 50 to 60%. And of the transport side, about 80% of the transport CO2 emissions are from us driving around. They're not from planes, it's not from freight, it's not from ships, it's from personal driving. We look at the cost of mitigating carbon in the economy. Kinsey & Company has been doing some great cost-benefit charts that show that where the national debate is, ethanol, hybrid cars, all this other stuff, big ag, absolutely the least cost-effective things we can be doing in order to reduce CO2. The most cost-effective things, in fact, the things that make money per ton of CO2 removed all have to do with making greater efficiency of our buildings and especially getting greater efficiency out of our transport system. We're doing climate change action work now for BART and finding that for BART, adding new parking at rail stations reduces CO2, but it comes at a cost of about $2,000 to almost $5,000 per ton of CO2 removed at a time when the international market for CO2 is about $30 per ton. We find that TOD, on the other hand, earns BART money between about $500 and $1,000 per ton of CO2 removed by eliminating parking and investing in carbon dioxide, investing in TOD. It also results in greater ridership revenue for the agency. But the most cost-effective thing that we've found so far, market pricing of parking, $2,000 per ton of CO2 removed, heading straight back into the economy, and investments in things that will help further reduce CO2. So adding all this up, U.S., 20% of the world's problem. Personal driving, about 20% of the problem in the U.S. Parking reform can cut VMT by about 25%. The land use things, more important, but longer term, what this suggests to me is that over the next 5 years, these 5 years being really critical if we're going to save the polar ice caps, the most cost-effective things we can do is to hit on VMT through reforms to how we're dealing with parking, that the potential there exceeds the potential for all other measures combined. Now, this is short-term, not long-term. In the long-term, the land use stuff completely wipes out the parking gains. But the sum total is greater than the entire CO2 emissions of Australia, the potential in the U.S., just by changing the way we manage parking. So how do we do this? Everyone says, great, all well and good, but it is in the book of Leviticus that we shall have free parking at all times, that parking shall be supplied in an unlimited amount. So the first thing that we need to do when I go and work in communities and tell them this stuff is we need to recognize that we live in a democracy and we need to protect existing residents who've made non-liquid decisions about auto ownership and where they live and the availability of parking in front of their house and establish residential parking permit districts so that we can get infill development and take away the NIMBY argument about fear of spillover parking. Here in Austin, Texas, one of the most innovative residential parking permit programs in the country, they allow residents of those permit districts to sell their daytime excess parking capacity to commuters and keep the net revenue for local neighborhood improvements. Park once strategies are also critically important. In conventional development, of course, we separate land uses. We require a separate parking lot for each land uses. And as a result, a trip, you know, dad taking Sally to school, he drives in off the arterial, parks, drops Sally off, he goes to work, requires another parking space, he picks Sally up from school, takes her to soccer practice, then goes and does some shopping, picks Sally up and then goes home. A lot of parking, a lot of turning movements, a lot of congestion. We wonder why we have problems in urban America. If we instead rearrange those uses on a grid, cluster them together, it requires about half of the parking because now suddenly parking can be shared. Even a driving trip, dad takes Sally to school, he parks once, Sally walks to school, he walks to work, Sally walks herself to soccer practice, he picks up some things on the way back to the car, they meet at the car and they go home. Same driving trip, radically different impact on vehicle miles traveled, on land area, on turning movements, and on congestion. In transit-oriented development, it gets even better because, of course, the result is that people can take care of all of their trips without even getting on the arterial at all. And, of course, if you let people live where they work and play, then all of your trips are confined into a simple area. What does all this mean? Well, when we go and actually collect data from mixed-use, rich urban centers, we find even in places where minimum parking requirements range from 5 spaces per thousand for office, 14 spaces per thousand for restaurant, we almost never see peak cumulative parking demand that exceeds 2 spaces per thousand. Now, and that would work if we required that parking be shared and if we required that parking be managed. Other things, on-street parking, incredibly important for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which, it's the most efficient way land-wise to provide parking. In terms of land area, on-street parking space, same amount of space per land area as a 3-story garage. Good parking design, Brian already talked about this, don't let parking kill your urban realm. Manage on-street parking, critically important, and really the lesson here is treat parking like any other commodity in our society. When we have a condition of scarcity for any other good, for necessary goods, for housing, for clothing, for bubble gum and utilities and electricity and anything, What do we do in order to manage conditions of scarcity? We increase the price. Parking and roadways are the only two commodities in our society that we use the Soviet communist method of allocation of scarcity. And in the economic world, congestion is to roadways as bread lines are to bread. So we have limited tools for allocating limited capacity, and the best really is to use price. We've got here at CNU, Rick Cole, Alan Loomis, Dan Zak, Redwood City, Ventura, and Glendale, California, also Pasadena, California, great examples of how using price to manage parking, and particularly reinvesting the revenue raised from that parking in the actual community, can not only create greater availability for parking, but can also raise money for local improvements, reduce VMT, improve the environment, help address congestion. And the results in Old Town Pasadena have been talked about a lot in Don Troop's book and others, how managing parking creates great economic returns. Redwood City, California has been doing a lot of experimentation as well, saying, we don't care what the price of parking is, staff, your job is to make sure that 15% of spaces are available at all times of day on every block face and every parking lot and every garage in the city. Importantly, in fact, perhaps most importantly in implementing any kind of pricing reform for parking is to recognize how it is tied to retail success. I can go into any retail store on any main street in the country, and they'll take seven forms of payment that are available in my wallet. I don't carry around rolls of quarters in my pocket, so make sure that you put in parking meters that accept credit cards, debit cards, and will allow you to fill up your meter with your cell phone. It's inexcusable to have quarters-only meters. Finally, adjusting your parking requirements so that they actually respond to local conditions is extremely important. I don't understand why anyone, other than out in the experts, ever consults the IPE Parking Generation Manual or the comparable manuals that have been developed by the ATA, by the American Planning Association. The data in there is from isolated, single-use suburban locations where there's no option for getting there other than by car. Yes, it is expensive to collect your own data, to get your own comps, but at $20,000 per parking space, you only need to save one parking space to cover your data collection costs. It's not that hard. Again, parking is like any other commodity in our society. You need to run a basic pro forma following the laws of supply and demand, looking at price, looking at the availability of alternatives, looking at your land use context. Parking demand varies more by location than it does by land use context. So how much is enough? Well, go to your own census data, run your household auto ownership rates by census block group, and you will see that in every community in the country, even on the residential side, regardless of income, you will find rich patterns of auto ownership with much lower rates of auto ownership and driving in downtown transit-oriented locations, much higher out in the more lower density, less transit-accessible places. Many communities now are realizing that there's absolutely no justification for minimum parking requirements at all. Why are we forcing developers to build more parking than the market would demand? It only creates negative social and economic implications. We don't need them. We don't need to force the development market in this way. And so a variety of cities all over the country, oddly, especially in Florida, in the state of Oregon, are dumping minimum parking requirements, particularly in their downtowns. And interestingly, minimum parking requirements are illegal as a matter of national law in the entirety of the United Kingdom because they've recognized that the social costs of minimum parking requirements greatly exceed any benefit. Similarly, cities around the country have either adopted or explored parking maximums as a tool for managing congestion. San Francisco is implementing parking maximums in all of its transit-oriented neighborhoods, not only to deal with congestion, but also to deal with housing affordability. So the lesson is, you cannot simultaneously have minimum parking requirements that result in unlimited free parking and pretend to care about climate change, about housing affordability, about traffic congestion, about social justice, about air quality, about water quality, or the environment. You need to set your parking requirements and vary them and adjust them according to a whole host of goals, not just making sure that you don't have to manage your on-street parking because you're terrified of having spillover parking onto your public streets. Making the transition is really tough. These ideas, of course, make sense to anyone who's an economist, but in our society, not so easy. So the rules, manage your spillover, give curb space of value, promote good, solid alternatives, parking cash out, car sharing programs, relate your parking rules to the larger goals of your community, address social equity head on so that you don't get into the argument about where the poor people will park, and of course, do lots and lots and lots of stakeholder and community outreach. Lots of books that are available, Shoup, Todd Littman, Reviewing, stuff from MPC, stuff that these folks have talked about up here, and with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Let's do questions. In theory, we're done in 2 minutes, but we won't price you based on how long you stay. So let's do questions, starting with Jeff, but also for the whole panel right there in front.
Can you flush out again your advocacy of resident permanent parking, the first point that you made? Because in Chicago, it's been real controversial around these successful retail districts.
Avoid restrictive residential parking permit programs if you possibly can. They are economically inefficient and socially unjust. If you, particularly in an urban area, can go straight to a market pricing approach, absolutely do it. And oftentimes the trick is reinvesting 100% of the net revenue raised in the district into the local community or 50% or whatever you need to get away with it, into local traffic calming, into street trees, into sidewalk repair, into whatever the local neighborhood wants. Oftentimes, when you're dealing with an existing established community and wanting to do intense urban infill development, democracy requires that in order to take away the power of the NIMBY argument, that you throw a restrictive residential permit program at the existing neighbors. So I could talk for hours about all the various permutations on that, but basically avoid them if you can go straight to market pricing, but if you need to, don't be shy about it, it's okay.
That one?
Did you write one of those books?
Absolutely. In fact, San Francisco has recognized that, and in the new transit-oriented development plans that have been approved in San Francisco, the city has established residential parking maximums of 0.25 to 0.75 spaces per unit, requires the unbundling of the cost of parking from the cost of housing, has basically forbidden commercial parking in its entirety. Because the whole host of factors that have to do with the quality of place, with vehicle congestion, but in San Francisco's case, in particular, housing affordability, what we find there is that the yuppies will move in and gentrify any neighborhood, no matter how lousy it is, but not if they don't have a place to park their SUV. So the goal there is to create lots and lots of teeny tiny little units with no parking in order to create an urban lifestyle and allow people who are interested in that to self-select into those neighborhoods. We find a great deal of self-selection based upon how parking is supplied. So if you want people who drive to the suburbs and drive around a lot and have a suburban lifestyle living in your city and commuting out to the suburban jobs, by all means, build big housing with lots of parking. But if you want people to participate in the urban pageant, build less parking.
Yeah, the other thing that we know from doing the research is that after people move in, car ownership goes down. And so they'll start with more cars, they'll realize that they don't need them. And the second part of the equation is, which is a more difficult part, is they use their cars less. So they're going to sit on the street longer and sit in the neighborhood longer if they're only dealing with off space. So you're not getting as much turnover because they don't need the car as much.
Yeah, and exurban locations, when you're doing these lifestyle-type centers and trying to make them downtowns of some way, shape, or form, as some of the projects I've worked on are, there are simple barriers you run into in order to get projects financed. The banks will ask for certain things. The tenants will ask for certain requirements. And the communities will actually ask for certain requirements. And it's hard to convince these interest groups of what you're trying to espouse when there's so many other data groups that aren't even well researched that no one has access to the ITE's parking generation numbers. The people that have seen them, and Mary Smith said in the presentation on Thursday, the only numbers in there that are statistically reliable are office building numbers. Even the ones that have been vetted through the ICSC for retail are not statistically reliable. So we've got a lot of issues out there with information and with countering this pseudoscience that exists. So we end up doing projects like that Frisco project. And again, the hope in that project for you back there is that before it gets built with those decks, that we'll find a way to get them more fine grained.
Part of it is in the Portland region, we struggled with parking, and the easiest way to push the parking down was to change the parking requirement for the entire region. So Portland has parking maximums for the entire region tied to the availability of service because we have a regional government that could do that. It was easier to convince the retailers because then they were all at the same disadvantage, they all, as they put it, and they all had to follow the same rules. And so dealing with this stuff on a piecemeal basis becomes a little bit harder. But if you can do it like all the UK or all the Portland metropolitan area, it's a little bit easier. You had a question there, and then some over here, and then I will remind you, we're technically done, but we'll stay and answer questions. We have, that's right, we have 10 more minutes, see? First a disclosure. I'll be at that meeting on Thursday and the one with the Planning Commission on Tuesday because we prepared the plans. In Austin, it's going to be a journey. And I guess the other thing that I would say in thinking about council on this is in Austin, you have a fine history through that citizen process of parcel by parcel spot zoning. Which means that you have broad standards for how you want to plan your community, and then you cave in on an individual site-by-site basis. And so I think the most important thing on the station area plans is to manage an entire station area and to think about it that way and stop yourself from your patterns of development of having individual opt-outs on how to deal with it. The other part of it is, let's spend the time and make sure that the ratios in the overlay zone for parking make sense. If they're too tight now, we can put a temporal piece into it so that they become tighter later, tight on the provision of service. Because I think, because you can the fact that we're in an economic downturn now means you're not building a lot of product in Plaza Saltillo. It means you're not building new product that hasn't already been permitted at Lamar in terms of what Trammell Crow is doing. You know, same thing at MLK. So there's going to be phasing on that, and that allows us and you the time to be able to tap those things down. My advice would be just go with it, and it will work. The relationships are there. But we also have to work with Capital Metro to hold up their end of the deal and provide actual real transit service.
I'd also add that we've completely dumped existing ways of dealing with parking and radically restructured them in about two dozen communities, and so far 100% success, and we've looked at another two dozen places that other people have done. One of the key lessons that we find, and it may be too late for you if you're going Thursday for approvals, is not to start with the question of how much parking should we be providing, but start with the larger questions of what kind of a place are we trying to create, what kind of goals do we have around housing affordability and congestion and other factors, and establish clear performance guidance about place, and then start asking what's the kind of parking ratios and parking management that are necessary in order to support the larger goal. So you need to get clear buy-in. And you need to be very strategic about how you get that buy-in and on what criteria in order for a logical conversation about parking to follow, because we always struggle with gross misconceptions among the public about the relationship between parking and other things. But in the end, I mean, there's some communities where we've actually ended up creating monsters out of the citizenry where they just want to ban parking entirely as a land use in their neighborhoods or merchant groups who, are demanding, the consultant's an idiot. He doesn't know our town. He says we want to, need to double the price of parking here. Don't listen to him because we need to triple the price of parking. Our customers need to find a space. Like, those are the kinds of things that I end up hearing at council hearings.
Well, and Jeff, happily here, the neighborhood is very engaged in the kind of place that they want to create. And then it's down into the details. So, Rick, you had a question there?
So Streetline is doing a demo project for the Port of San Francisco for all of the parking spaces along the Embarcadero, where the former Embarcadero freeway used to run. The data that you get is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I'm a total data whore, and it's just great looking at everything that they can produce. It's like it's almost too much for me. Where I think the real advantages lie is not only in being able to do dynamic pricing of parking, but to be able to export that data, because you get it live, to people's GPS devices in their car and to their PDAs, so that somebody driving into San Francisco will know exactly where the empty spaces lie, what the price of those spaces are, what any restrictions are, and the little machine will guide you right to it. And that's one of the next things that they're working on developing.
Yeah, Melbourne does that in their downtown with signage. And so you go through the major streets, and it tells you, turn on this street, and there's 100 spaces available. Go that way, and there's 0 spaces available. Mm-hmm. And it really cuts down on that moving around.
Does your study really have any recommendations on public policy interventions, or is it strictly data analysis, or will it go
We'll have some recommendations on recommended practice and what to do. We're not going to go into the detail that Jeff's been talking about, because I think those things are well understood, and we're trying to stay within the nexus between what to do with trip generation and with transit and next steps on how to apply that. And to be candid, our target audience is ITE and ULI, because we want to work with the people that are doing the guidance and what to do there.
Todd Littman's book is quite useful in policy guidance. Of like pay and display or pay by space systems.
Well, there's one up there too.
Yeah.
Yeah. How much do they tend to cost with payback?
So it varies depending upon context and depending upon what you're managing for, as well as the technology you choose. What's interesting is that so they have a pretty high upfront capital cost, higher than conventional meters. The cost has come down substantially because they're no longer required to be hardwired. They're solar powered, and they communicate with each other wirelessly. So that, over the last 5 years, has resulted in significant capital cost savings. Depending upon your parking policies, the impact varies a lot depending upon, some communities have found a very, very significant increase in the amount of money that they make per space, because rates of compliance are much higher. People, are actually paying because it's now so easy to pay, which has in turn allowed them to increase the fee because it's now easy to pay. You've removed this huge transactional cost. Other cities, though, have found that their enforcement revenue has gone way down because it's now easy to pay. People, because you don't have to carry quarters around with you. In summary, every case study that we've looked at, and we've done probably about a dozen different cities, every single one of them, it's been revenue positive. The payback time has varied from, I believe, about 6 months to 2 years. But it's a pretty short payback time, and I haven't found a city that has installed them and gone back. So like Portland and Seattle are now 100% pay station. They've gotten rid of all of their meters. Cities like Oakland and Berkeley are heading in that direction.
The other thing on the pay stations is it takes away you being able to park for free because somebody left time on the meter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets to park for free anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that also increases the revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get to pay for it twice.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, if there are no more questions, I just want to thank everybody. Obviously, we could spend a lot of time on parking. Parking is really key to being able to create the kind of communities that we want. And applying these practices and the rates, the design, and the management of how we deal with parking is what it's all about. So thank you very much.
Good job to you.